So Leslie.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. The Senate Judiciary Committee, first I want to apologize to those in the committee as well as those in the audience. We had a change in my schedule that I had to be somewhere from 8:30 until 8:40. That's why we reposted from 8:45. And so we're going to get started. It looks like today we have four bills for public hearing, and we have two that are going to work session. So we'll start with the public hearing since one of my members isn't here yet. I mean, he is here, but he's not here currently. Let's go ahead and start with the public hearing on Senate Bill 495.
Thank you, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. Senate Bill 495 has to do with the regulation of the sale of securities. Currently, plaintiff prevailing in action based on fraud regarding the sale of a security may not recover attorney fees to a prevailing defendant if the action is maintained as a class action. This bill requires a court or arbiter to award reasonable attorney's fees to the prevailing plaintiff in action based on fraud or material omission in the sale of a security. Provides a condition or stipulation that requires a person to waive compliance with the Oregon securities law is invalid and permits the Director of Consumer and Business Services to recover costs and reasonable attorney's fees in an action for a violation of Oregon securities law.
I wish I could say we're going to have CLE credit for this one. It sounds like one that I would benefit from. So I have two people that are scheduled to testify. Stephen, is it Vernon? Okay, I'm trying to read the last name here. And Bob Banks, if you two would come forward, please. Is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 495?
Mr. Chair, if I could just make an introductory comment, yes. Since it's a bill that I'm sponsoring. I just wanted to let the committee know that the main goal of this bill is to make it more likely that victims of scams can seek a remedy, but also to deter fraud in the marketplace. So I'm going to let the experts explain the bill.
Thank you. And gentlemen, whoever would like to go first, just put your name on the record and we'll listen.
Thank you, Senator Prezonsky, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. My name is Bob Banks, and I am honored to be here to discuss Senate Bill 495 with you. I'll say a little bit about my perspective and what I do. I have been practicing law in Oregon for more than 25 years, and most of my time in that last 25 years has been representing investors who have been victims of various investment scams. I come from a small practice. There are three people in my office. We don't do large class actions. We represent individuals and families, and I haven't done an analysis, but I would say that half or more than half of my clients are senior citizens and have been over the years. I'm a little concerned and defensive that the committee will think, well, here comes a lawyer in front of the panel to argue that there should be more attorney fees in the court system. And I'm not a wide-eyed, well, maybe wide-eyed, but I'm not a wild plaintiff's lawyer. I have been involved in a number of different organizations with diverse groups. I've been, for the last 7 years, an advisor to the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority in New York and D.C. I've been on committees at the request of the Oregon Department of Business and Consumer Services. I was a former chair of the Oregon Securities section of the bar, and other things. And I think I have a fairly balanced view on these issues. So getting to Senate Bill 495, there are three substantive provisions in the bill, and I'd like to talk briefly about each of them. The first one would make Oregon law apply specifically to arbitrations. And the reason for that is, the reason why it's important is that the committee may know that when anybody in the United States opens a brokerage account with any of the 5,000 brokerage firms in the United States, they sign a form, and typically on the back of that form there is a provision that says that they waive their right to go to court and they will have their any disputes heard in arbitration before FINRA. And so That's where all of any claim that an investor has against a brokerage firm that has done something either dishonest or illegal will end up being heard. And FINRA has some positive aspects to it. I'm generally in favor of it, but there are some problems. And the main problem is that the arbitrators aren't required to follow the Oregon law. And the way that the statute is written now, it specifically refers, ORS 59115 sub 10 specifically refers to attorney fees being available in court, but it says nothing about arbitration, even though that's where most of these cases end up. And it just seems like a matter of fairness that the citizens of this state, if they have claims to be made, that they should be entitled to the laws that this legislature, that our legislature has enacted in arbitration as well as in court. And so I think that addition of those two words in arbitration are significant and necessary and important. The second thing that Senate Bill 495 would do is it would make an award of attorney fees applicable to plaintiffs only. Right now, the statute allows the court to award attorney fees to prevailing parties, and so it would change to only plaintiffs would be entitled to that. And the idea of awarding attorney fees to whoever prevails seems like a reasonable thing at first blush. But because of the economic disparity between the parties in these cases, it really does create a problem. And the reason is that, you know, the threat to a large Wall Street firm of possibly having to pay attorney fees to an investor in a claim is not very significant. It's not going to affect their conduct or the way that they handle themselves in the arbitration. But it's going to have a big impact on an individual or a family that has been defrauded. Because you can never, no lawyer can ever tell any client, no matter how badly they've been abused, that they have a 100% chance of winning. There's always a chance that any case could be lost, and so you have to advise your clients that, yes, there is some chance you could lose, and there is some chance that you would have to pay the other side's attorney's fees if you lose. I have never seen that happen in any of my cases, and it's extremely rare in any forum that I'm aware of for attorney fees to be awarded against an investor, even if they lose. But it's the threat and the possibility of that happening that does deter people from bringing legitimate claims, because they just can't take that risk of maybe not only having lost their savings, but having a $100,000 attorney fee award against them. And so I would also mention that the Oregon statute used to provide that attorney fees were only available to prevailing plaintiffs. The Uniform Securities Act, on which our statute is loosely based, provides in Section 509 that attorney fees are to be awarded to plaintiffs. And if you surveyed the laws of the various states, the majority of them do have attorney fee provisions that are plaintiff only in their blue sky statutes. Let me turn finally to the third provision of 495, the substantive change, and that would change the current law, which allows a court to make an award of attorney fees to a mandatory provision, so that attorney fees would have to be awarded to the prevailing party. And the importance of this section really has to do with small claimants. As an economic matter, it is just extremely difficult to take a case and represent an aggrieved investor that has lost $50,000, even $75,000, because they can't afford typically to pay on an hourly basis. And we do most of our cases on a contingency fee. But as I said in my written testimony that I submitted, we do keep track of this, and these cases take a lot of time. The average in my office is 160 attorney hours to take a case from the time you do the intake to the time it goes through the arbitration award process. And so if you take a case on a contingency fee, even if you recover every dime for that person, it's going to be a losing proposition. You won't be able to pay your overhead in taking those cases. Now, we take some of them just because we should, but there are many more that we turn away, and I don't know this for a fact, but I believe that there are many people that go unrepresented that have lost $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, a significant sum of money to most people, but they just can't afford to pay the attorneys to take a case of that size. But if the statute were to require attorney fees to a prevailing plaintiff, we would certainly take more of those cases, and I think other good lawyers in the state would do the same. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Bob. Stephen?
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Berman. I'm an attorney with the Stoll Burn firm in Portland, and I'm also here to testify in support of Senate Bill 495. I provided the committee with written testimony, which actually addresses both Senate Bill 495 and 497. I won't echo everything I wrote here, but I do want to emphasize a handful of points. The first was made by Mr. Banks, which is Senate Bill 495 will return us to the state that we were in 1995 and bring our law parallel to the law of the majority of other states that follow the Model Act on allowing prevailing plaintiff attorney's fees. This bill, as well as Senate Bill 497, are both predominantly fair, and particularly fair to small investors. As Mr. Banks pointed out, the vast majority of claimants that we see in these securities claims are seniors. These are people whose life savings have been taken from them by unscrupulous investment advisors. These are folks who are terrified at the prospect of having lost everything, of also now facing simply the threat of having to pay a large firm's attorney's fees should they lose. As Mr. Banks pointed out, neither his firm nor my firm frequently encounter scenarios where plaintiffs are required to pay attorney's fees, but that threat is often enough to discourage folks from pursuing claims. And this is a real experience that we have had. As an example, my firm recently brought litigation against a major investment house for a number of senior investors who had been victims of wrongdoing. There were three or four more investors who had been victims of the same wrongdoing who declined to pursue claims simply because when we presented to them the threat of having to pay the other side's attorney's fees, that was too much for them. Now, what the shame is that the investors that we pursued claims for all prevailed. And you have four investors who were wronged, the arbitrators found were wronged, who simply did not pursue their claims because of the threat of fees. As we've emphasized in the written testimony as well, this also protects small business owners in particular. These are folks who have built their life savings, usually self-directed their investments with some control with an investment advisor. These are often the folks that we find after having built their nest eggs who have been taken advantage of. Something that I wanted to emphasize that I didn't emphasize in my written testimony is that allowing private enforcement reduces the burden on DCBS and the state, who also has enforcement authority. Private plaintiff enforcement often results in investigations and results that are equivalent to what the state would accomplish without tapping into the state's resources so they can focus elsewhere. And the final point, which is in our written testimony as well, is that defendants are still protected by ORS 20.105. That's a statute that was enacted in 1995 that provides that should a defendant prevail on a case because the plaintiff had no objectively reasonable basis for pursuing the claim, the defendant must be awarded his attorney's fees. That is a mandatory fee provision for defendants that already exists, and it is a low standard. It is not a particularly high standard. If a plaintiff is bringing a bad case, a frivolous claim, a claim that should not be brought, a defendant is entitled to recover his attorney's fees. Something I didn't emphasize at the outset, but which is in my written testimony, is that my firm and I represent plaintiffs and defendants in securities litigation, and we're here testifying in favor of this bill.
All right, thank you. Questions for the panel? Senator Wissa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How often does the director of DCBS actually end up paying court costs because they were not objectively, had no objective reasonable basis for asserting the claim? I mean, isn't that a pretty high threshold?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator, how often does DCBS end up paying? I'm not sure when DCBS brings its own enforcement actions. How often does if your question is how often does a plaintiff in a securities case end up paying the defendant's fees, it does not happen to our clients. I do not believe it happens to Mr. Banks' clients because we do a good job of filtering our claims. It may happen. I've certainly had that threat brought against my clients.
The question was actually the other side of it. How often does the defendant, is the defendant able to prove that, able to prove in court that they're entitled to their attorney fees?
I have won that argument three times in non-securities cases.
That doesn't answer the question, really. I mean, is that... That's anecdotal. Do you have any statistics?
I do not.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if either of you, Mr. Banks or Mr. Berman, could explain the process that you go through to analyze whether you should bring a case, whether the case has merit.
I'd be happy to do that, Senator Bonamici. Actually, the evaluation phase of the case is one of the more intensive parts of the representation process, especially when you are taking a case as a lawyer on a contingency fee, because, of course, there's not going to be any payment unless you prevail on the case. And there are also the ethical requirements that you cannot, as a lawyer, bring a case unless you have investigated and believe that there is a basis for a claim. So, I mean, just specifically what we do in my office, and most of our cases are against investment advisors, we get a full history of the client's account statements. We get we get their tax returns going back 5 years, so we know what kind of investments they made, how much money they have made. We interview them at least two times. Oftentimes more. We do background research on the possible defendant to see if they have any history of other bad conduct. And oftentimes we consult with an expert in the securities industry about the specific misconduct to get opinions on their opinion and view on rules that were violated, whether they should have been caught before they did what they did, that sort of thing. So it's a very extensive process.
All right, any other questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Stephen wants you to stay where you're at. And I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 495, open the public hearing on 497.
Thank you.
Just 1 second.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 497 pertains to two different types of suits. First of all, the prosecution of antitrust suits by the Attorney General, and second of all, claims made by unpaid or underpaid employees against their employers. Proposed Senate Bill 497 would modify both of these sections to modify the law recovering when attorney's fees and other costs of litigation may be recovered by a prevailing party in these types of proceedings.
All right, and I'd also like to call up, is it Keith Dubanovich?
Dubanovich,
sorry. Stephen, why don't you go ahead and lead off?
Thank you. Senator Brzezinski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Stephen Berman. I'm a lawyer with the Stoll Burn firm, and I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 497. Most of what I said regarding Senate Bill 495 applies to Senate Bill 497 as well from the private enforcement perspective, and I believe Mr. Dubanovich will speak from the state's perspective on the enforcement aspects. The only additional point I wanted to emphasize, in addition to the written and verbal testimony I gave on Senate Bill 495, is especially with the antitrust provision of this bill and the fee shifting on the antitrust. This is a bill that protects, in particular, Oregon businesses, small Oregon businesses either trying to break into a market or work within a market that is being dominated or controlled by anti-competitive practices. We do not see very many antitrust claims pursued on a state level in this era, frankly, but when we do, it almost always involves an Oregon manufacturer who's being shut out of a national market by a larger national or multinational manufacturer through anti-competitive practices. On the wage and hour claims, the fee shifting provision here is something that would clearly benefit the most vulnerable of Oregon's workers. These are the folks who usually are working at minimum wage jobs or slightly above minimum wage jobs, who aren't paid, and whom the threat, again, of a defendant recovering his attorney's fees often is simply a deterrent to pursuing claims. And again, my firm has had experience representing multiple plaintiffs where some plaintiffs have chosen not to go forward because of the threat of attorney's fees, where other plaintiffs have, in fact, ended up prevailing on their claims. That's all I have to add to my prior testimony.
Thank you very much, Keith.
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz, my name is Keith Dubanovich, and I appreciate the opportunity to come speak this morning. We appreciate the clarification of when the Department of Justice can recover fees and expenses. As the committee may know, bringing an antitrust case is extremely time-consuming and therefore very expensive, whether brought by a private party or by the State Department of Justice. In our view, anything that facilitates private parties being able to resolve their dispute without relying upon state government relieves us of the burden of pursuing an action on behalf of Oregon consumers or Oregon businesses, and this bill appears to assist in that regard. One point of clarification, and that is to address the question, or maybe to clarify on the record, that the Attorney General or private parties can recover their fees and expenses even if there is no appeal. And let me point you to line 16 of Section 1. It indicates that the Attorney General can recover investigative costs and fees and expenses if the Attorney General prevails in an action under this section at trial and on appeal. I raise that because there are frequently cases that are never appealed, and we want to make sure that we can recover those fees and expenses that are brought only as a result of a trial that we succeed in, that we don't have to have an appeal to recover our fees and expenses. I know it's technical, but it is a great concern to us because we do pursue a lot of cases that never go up on appeal.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Senator Cruz.
I guess I have a concern. Section 3, sub D, lines 39 through 42. It looks like the deletion and the addition of language is making it even harder for the court to make a determination that the Attorney General acted outside of what he should have done. I mean, current law is no reasonable basis, and now you're going to act it in bad faith. That seems like a much higher bar to have to move over. And it's a concern. Why that language changed?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Cruz, I have no idea. I wasn't involved in this bill at all. Obviously, from our perspective, we don't assert any claim if we don't have a reasonable basis to do so. So I'm comfortable with the language in either direction.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just out of curiosity, could you give us an example of what the Attorney General would have to do to be found by the court to be in bad faith, vexatiously, wantonly, or for oppressive reasons? What would he have to do that? Where is that bar?
Chair Przanski, Senator Whitsitt,
just sitting here, I can't come up with an easy example, but maybe, for example, if the Attorney General or one of our lawyers had an ulterior motive that was not based upon the evidence in the case, and we pursued a case for vindictive reasons, that would be an improper case that under this standard would allow the other party to recover fees.
Thank you. Keith, just one thing. And another way, I guess, is if the attorney actually had knowledge of a claim that they were bringing forward was not right, was inappropriate, and was based on false allegations, whatever, that would be another one that...
Chair Pozanski, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify Mr. Dubanovich's concern about Section 1, Line 16. His and the Department of Justice's concern is what I was intending by this bill, that it not, there need not be an appeal, that it would be at trial and on appeal if there is an appeal. So clarify that, and I'm willing to work on clarifying language on that. And I'm certainly willing to ask Legislative Council where the language came from in Section 3, but certainly if the Department of Justice is comfortable with the existing language, I'm certainly flexible on that as well.
Alrighty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Cruz,
pencil up. Yeah, and I guess while we're looking at Section 1, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I'm wondering why the deletion of the language that would allow the defendant to collect as well. I guess, Mr. Chair, I prefer to see situations where if we're going to attach jeopardy, it attaches both ways.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 497? Not seeing anyone, we'll close that public hearing. We're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 519.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 519 pertains to the sale of certain properties brought about in a foreclosure action, specifically those that are subject either to an affordable housing covenant or subject to an interest by a public body. Affordable housing covenant meaning a non-possessory interest basically designed to encourage the development of affordable rental and owner-occupied housing for low-income individuals. Essentially, if one of those property goes into foreclosure, this grants those parties the first right to purchase the property for the lesser of the sum total of the obligation secured by trust deed or mortgage on the property that is owed, and due to all persons that have interest in the property or the highest bid received for the property by someone other than them. As a practical matter, this is essentially the right of first refusal for those parties.
All right, thank you. I have two people that have signed up on the witness registration, Jesse Beeson and Allison McIntosh.
Mr. Chair, since I would like my legislative assistant who's worked on this, if she can come up also and give an introduction.
That's fine. Okay. Leslie?
Thank you.
And is there going to be anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 519? So, Leslie, I think you're going to lead off.
Yes. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to appear before you today. For the record, my name is Leslie Derman. I'm a staffer for Senator Jackie Dingfelder, and I am very privileged to be able to introduce this bill, give a very brief introduction of what Senate Bill 519 does, and introduce the excellent work that Mr. Beeson has been doing and that Proud Ground has been doing on this bill. So the background leading up to Senate Bill 519 is that for the past several sessions, Senator Dingfelder has been working on affordable housing issues. And the organization with which Senator Dingfelder has been working most closely is Proud Ground, formerly known as Portland Community Land Trust. And in 2010, the staff of Proud Ground approached the senator to suggest a legislative solution to a problem that they had seen developing. This problem is that with the increasing number of foreclosures, many of these foreclosures are on affordable housing stock. And the problem was that as the homes were being foreclosed, they were leaving the affordable housing stock and going to purchasers who did not meet the income eligibility standards. And for these properties, entities invest a lot of money and other resources to ensure that they are affordable housing stock. And the goal of 519 is to keep these homes in the affordable housing stock. And the solution that 519 proposes to ensure that they stay in the affordable housing stock is they give the holder of an affordable housing covenant the first opportunity to purchase that affordable housing property when it goes into foreclosure. And thank you. We are very fortunate to have Jesse Beeson, the Executive Director of Proud Ground, to answer further questions on this bill.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Jesse Beeson. Today I represent both the organization I lead, Proud Ground, as well as the Northwest Community Land Trust Coalition and also the Housing Alliance. Senate Bill 519 and the Dash 2 amendments do a very narrow and specific but important thing. That is to protect the public subsidy used in making a home affordable to low and moderate income families when that home is in foreclosure. Proud Ground and many other organizations across the state use a unique model in helping low-income families buy their first home. We invest public dollars to lower the purchase price of a home forever. This means that the home will always serve low-income families, allowing them to build equity, but ensuring that the family that follows them will be able to afford the home as well. As you can imagine, since what we do is so unique, many lenders, title companies, and cash investors aren't looking for us when a home is in foreclosure. This means a lender can unwittingly sell and an investor can unwittingly purchase one of our homes without understanding just how unique it is. For instance, our homes require that you live in them, that you make below a certain income, and that you never sell your home for its full market value. This profile is generally opposite the intent of someone bidding at foreclosure sale. So this bill would prevent such needless mistakes on a very tiny subset of homes. It would require that we show up, like anyone else, at foreclosure sale and bid to purchase the home by either matching the market bid or making the lender whole, whichever is less. There's no extra step required by the lender, the trustee, or the title company, and there's no burden on the cash investor. I should note that Proud Ground has not lost a single home to foreclosure in our 12 years of existence. And among organizations like ours across the state, there has been just one. But in looking at horror stories across the country, where small nonprofits spend tens of thousands of dollars in legal costs to rectify a mistaken purchase by an investor, we simply hope to prevent similar misfortune in our state. We consider many in the lending community to be our partners in this work. They have worked hand in hand with us to deliver traditional mortgages at fixed rates to our families. We believe our work with them on this bill and its amendments has kept its focus narrow and its implementation minimal. I want to thank and recognize Senator Dingfelder for her leadership on this bill, and I stand ready to answer your questions. Again, thank you for the opportunity to express my support for Senate Bill 519 and the Dash 2 amendments.
All right, thank you. And Allison?
Yes. Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, thank you for your time today. My name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm the Policy Manager for Neighborhood Partnerships, which convenes the Housing Alliance. The Housing Alliance is a coalition of organizations from across the state that have come together out of a concern for those in our communities that do not have a safe, stable, and affordable place to call home, or access to a community that provides a range of opportunities and services. We know that we all benefit when our neighbors have full access to opportunity. The Housing Alliance believes that maintaining a range of approaches and options that bring a variety of partners together to build and maintain affordable housing will help us create that opportunity. We have many tools and strategies that work to help Oregonians find places to call home, either in rental housing or homeownership. One effective strategy to help first-time homebuyers is through shared appreciation models, like a community land trust, where public and nonprofit investment lowers the purchase price for low-income homebuyers forever, keeping the home affordable for generations to come. This proven strategy works for many first-time homebuyers. However, in this difficult economy, foreclosure can happen to anyone, even those who have had public support. When foreclosure happens in these situations, public agencies and nonprofit organizations could lose all of their investment to a private investor. This loss denies future potential homeowners the opportunity to own their first home and benefit someone who doesn't need the support. Senate Bill 519 solves this problem in a way that's fair to the bank and the nonprofit or public agency. A simple change in statute would allow the nonprofit or public agency to purchase the home from the bank at a fair price. This keeps the public subsidy available for future first-time homebuyers and still allows the bank to recoup its costs. We all have a stake in addressing the problems that our communities and neighbors are facing as a result of the recession. In this difficult financial climate, it's our responsibility to protect public investment. This change will allow us to continue to ensure homeownership options in our community. A variety of tools and strategies are needed to maintain housing that's affordable in our communities. When significant public dollars are at stake, nonprofits and public agencies should be allowed to protect public investment in the case of foreclosure. By allowing these organizations to go to the head of the line to purchase homes at a fair price at foreclosure sales, we will ensure this option is available for future homeowners. We urge your support of Senate Bill 519 with the -2 amendments. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions? Senator Wissa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you not already have the ability to protect your subordinate investment under current law?
We do not. And the reason that is because our unique model essentially divorces the land from the improvements, so that the home is essentially separated from the land. So in foreclosure, the bank is foreclosing on the home itself. And so we don't necessarily have what is traditionally seen as a subordinate amount of subsidy in second position through a trust deed. What we do have is separate ownership of the land and essentially a contract in place that puts in the provisions for the ownership of the home on which the land sits. And that is why there can be difficulty in a foreclosure situation, because most folks are looking for a traditional trust deed in second position to say, oh, there's another person in line, so to speak, on this home. But for us, we don't have that. We use a different model, and it is indeed unique. And that's why we've seen across the country that when folks aren't necessarily looking for us, they don't find us.
Yeah. One follow-up, please. You've mentioned the term fair price. You should be able to protect your investment by offering a fair price. How is that fair price established, and fair to whom?
So, I would say there would be potentially two points. The lender certainly hopes to be made whole, and this bill seeks to do that. And not just the lender foreclosing, but anybody in a superior position to us. Second, we also hope to match, if, for instance, the market has gone down dramatically, then we hope to simply match what the market would do. And I think the foreclosure sales statutes that exist right now set up that whatever the highest bid at foreclosure sale, that is indeed the fair price, that is the market value paid. So our hope is simply to match those two. So the lender, I believe, hopes to be made whole, and the current statute says after the lender is made whole, any excess proceeds goes to anyone else in line, and if there's no one else in line, it goes to the original owner of the home. And so this would not change those policies.
And one follow-up. Let's say, just for an example, is a $200,000 house, and it's secured for $200,000, and now it's only worth $150,000. Would this bill allow you to protect your investment by buying the house for $150,000 and prevent the bank from bidding the full $200,000 to protect their investment?
No, we can only match either what the bank is owed. So if the bank were owed $200,000, that would be what we could match. If the bank bid $200,000 at the foreclosure sale, that's the bid that we would have to match. Now, if the bank doesn't bid and another cash investor comes and says $150,000, then we're simply saying we will match that.
Thank you.
All right, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand your issue on protecting your unique sort of covenant.
Uh-huh.
My question is, because it also includes that subject to an interest by a public body, how wide of a hole are we creating with that language?
I appreciate the question. So that concern was also raised by the Oregon Bankers Association when we met with them. And I think in the first draft from Legislative Council, they didn't quite pick up that our intent was to focus on affordable housing covenant holders. So in the Dash 2 amendments, we eliminate or public bodies in the phrasing, because affordable housing covenant holders is already defined in statute, and it's pretty narrow in its intent and purpose.
It should be in your packet. Okay, and thank you for that. I haven't had a chance to drill through this yet, so
yeah.
But that was a concern.
Yeah, I think it's a fair concern, and we hope that these, and believe that these amendments address that.
I assume that you and the others would be available if there's questions. We're in public hearing today, so.
Sure.
Any of the members have any follow-up questions based on the Dash 2s, once you have a chance to get through it, you can contact them directly.
Absolutely.
All right. Any other comments or questions from the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. And just want to check one more time. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 519? Kevin, y'all, if you'd step back, I got one more person that's coming up.
Members of the committee, Kevin Christensen, Oregon Bankers Association. I'll be very, very brief. For the most part, we do agree with Mr. Beeson. We've been trying to work with him with respect to finding a good solution, and we appreciate his work coming to us and working with us. I know many of our lenders have worked with Proud Ground and other organizations. My interpretation of the bill, I guess two points that I would make. First of all, with respect to the bill itself, at the foreclosure process, the text, or at least what would be reflected in the amendment of the bill, provides that the covenant holder could recover the property for the lesser of either the total sum of obligations that is owed and due to a person, or the highest bid received, whatever the lesser of that is. So I think there could be a situation, theoretically, in which if it's a $200,000 property and there's $150,000, the bank may not be hold. On the other hand, I think there's also an issue, though. Most banks in a foreclosure process is going to do essentially what I would call like a credit bid, where they have the amount owing, and then they're going to probably submit the first bid and say this is the amount that we're going to be seeking to recover. So I would clarify that. The other issue that I raise in discussions with Mr. Beeson as well is we are trying to narrow this considerably in talking with the stakeholders and Senator Cruz with the issue you raised. We'd like to find some possibly additional language that narrows it further, but again, that's something that we're trying to work with the stakeholders with respect to that. Obviously, land trusts and our banks have expressed interest in definitely working with them and see if we can find a good solution, but it is something that we are trying to narrow a little further, so that's all I have.
All right. Thank you very much for coming forward. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 519. We're going to open up our last public hearing for today, Senate Bill 607.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 607 would modify the existing crime of offensive littering, which is generally a Class C misdemeanor, to create a subset for the new offense of unlawful disposal of a tobacco product. This would occur if an individual knowingly disposed of a cigarette or cigar or a filter from either upon the land of another without the permission of the owner or upon any public way. This offense would constitute a Class D violation punishable by a maximum fine of $90.
All right, I have three individuals that are scheduled to testify. Deb Schallert, Mary Ellen Holland, and Sarah, is it Fritz? Please come forward. And for the committee, this is a bill that I introduced at the request of Deb and her husband. This was something we saw maybe 2 years ago that was, let's say, taking a different approach based on my knowledge of the offensive littering statute, that we thought that this would be a better place for it to go, with a maximum fine being set forth in the statute itself. So, Deb.
Great. Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Deb Schallert, and as Chair Brzezinski mentioned. He helped us on this legislation. We appreciate your support for this. I'm here today to simply provide a couple of points. You already have my statement, so I won't go through that. But we were here a couple of years ago. This concept got through the House. We're hoping on this side that it goes just as well. And I think with this improvement in the position for the language, it'll have a better chance of going through. As a former park ranger with Oregon State Parks, part of why I brought this bill forward is because I personally have picked up thousands of cigarette butts on our public waterways, beaches, and parks, and saw firsthand how pervasive this litter is. 25 years ago, I helped coordinate the first beach cleanup sponsored by the Parks and Recreation Department. To this day, it's still the number one source of litter in public places and a source of wildfires in our rural areas. So I encourage your support for this legislation. I think a couple of things I'd also like to mention is there are opportunities for people to take personal responsibility for disposal of cigarette butts, and I've provided some of these individual ashtrays if you'd like some with your staff over here. These are available, and even something as simple as an Altoids can be carried by individuals, so this isn't something that puts an additional burden on taxpayers. If anything, I believe that this type of change in attitude for taking personal responsibility for litter is something that Oregon can be a leader in, and I am available for questions if you have any other comments or questions on this legislation. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mary Ellen. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, thank you. Senator Brzezinski, thank you. Senator Cruz and other members of the committee, my name is Mary Ellen Hawley. I'm the president and CEO of the Keep Oregon Green Association, which, by the way, is celebrating 70 years of wildfire prevention. Today I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 607. Keep Oregon Green Association keeps statewide wildfire stats so that we know where to focus our efforts to change behaviors. And one of the behaviors that we would really like to change is that of those people who throw their cigarettes out of their vehicles, whether or not they're burning. And I guess that was one of the questions that was to be clarified here, is that some people thought that their cigarettes were out so they could throw them anyway. In the past 10 years, cigarettes have caused 522 wildfires on lands protected by the Oregon Department of Forestry at a cost of $4.9 million of taxpayer money. Now, those 522 were just those fires that didn't reach that reached more than one-tenth of an acre. If firefighters respond and it's less than a tenth of an acre, they're not called statistical fires. Of those 522 wildfires, 85 were the result of people throwing them out of their vehicles, costing taxpayers $182,545. Currently, the Keep Oregon Green Association has our logo on ODOT signs on the highway. That state throwing burning material from a vehicle is worthy of a fine of $150. This bill is more specific. And whether or not the cigarette is burning, it will be unlawful to throw it out of your vehicle. I urge you to support Senate Bill 607 with a due pass recommendation. And thank you for giving me your time today.
Good. Thank you. Sarah?
Yes, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Fritsch. Thank you very much for giving me some time today. I have two small babies at home. I work outside the home, and just getting myself down to Salem this morning hopefully is testimony enough about how much I care about this issue. I really believe in this process, and I'm here because of that, and I just want to make this world a better place for my kids. In 2008, as a member of the Class of Leadership Portland, Class of 2008, I led a campaign to raise awareness about cigarette butt litter and just how toxic and gross it is. That was a multi-channel campaign, and it culminated in an event that we called the Butt Hunt, which coincided with Earth Day 2008. At that event, we collected by hand in 2 hours 25,000 cigarette butts from downtown Portland. I'm a mechanical engineer, and I'm not an environmental scientist, but I have done some preliminary research, which a quick Google, any of you could do as well, and it just tells you how toxic cigarette butt litter is. The bulk of it ends up in our water. It takes about 12 years for any cigarette butt to break down, and it never actually fully breaks down. It just seeps chemicals into our earth and our water. This is not an anti-smoking legislation. It's anti-litter, and I think that's an important differentiation. Oregon is a green leader in many ways, and I think that we're well positioned to continue to be a green leader by passing Senate Bill 607. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments? Not seeing any. Oh, just, Senator Wessel.
Thank you. Just a question of counsel. What is the current sanction for a Class C misdemeanor? This apparently takes cigarette butt littering from a Class C to a Class D.
It takes this one particular area to a Class D violation. The Class C misdemeanor is a fine of $720. No, $1,200. Yeah.
It's in that range.
Plus potential of up to 30 days in jail.
Right. A Class C?
A Class C.
That's correct.
And a violation is non-criminal, so there's no jail sanctions that's available.
And the $90 would be a maximum fine, and
yes, so
the matter of course could be lower.
So actually, if you were to be sanctioned for throwing cigarette butts out now under a Class C misdemeanor, you would get fined several hundred dollars and could spend some time in jail. But if you do it under this new law, you'd only get fined $90 and have no possibility of putting in jail. Which one prevails?
There's two.
Senator, Chair Przanski, Senator Whitsitt, in the existing regime right now, there is a subsection for just refuse and trash, and I think you can make a good argument that cigarette butts would fall under that section existing now, which would classify as a Class C misdemeanor. However, if Senate Bill 396 went through, that subsection for just cigarette butts would be controlling. It would become sort of a caveat within the rule of refuse.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And I think the other part is that if the cigarette butt was actually still lighted and it could be proven, I think the fines that were in place for being lighted material would still apply.
Yeah, I believe so.
And Chair Przanski, Senator Whitsitt, at that point, depending on circumstances, you can even find yourself in territory for something like reckless burning if there's able to show an indifference to whether it was lit.
All right. Any other comments or questions? Senator Cruz.
I want to make sure I'm perfectly clear, because currently cigarette butts are considered to be litter at this point. So this bill would lower the penalty for throwing a cigarette butt out of a car from what currently exists.
Well, you're getting into an area that's if you threw lighted material out of a car, that is one independent statute.
Right. But if it's unlighted, in other words, if somebody threw their butt out, it would currently, it would be treated the same as anything else in the definition of litter, and it would be a Class C, but this would lower the penalty significantly for doing the same thing that now they could be fined.
Could be. That's correct. And I guess what I would also say is that I think on an enforcement process, there'd be more, I think law enforcement would be more willing to actually cite someone for the violation where it involves a cigarette butt as compared to maybe charging them with a crime. Because as we all know, if with a crime, you open up the door for having public defender appointed if the person is eligible for such resources.
But if I could, Mr. Chair, I'd also assume at this point, it is a Class C, but it could be, there's discretion, there's downward discretion in how it's dealt with.
Today, what they could do as a Class C misdemeanor, they could charge it as an attempt, and an attempt will drop it down one level, which would be a Class A violation. Right. And there the fine,
I don't remember off the top of my head.
Probably close to $1,000 as a max. I forget, maybe $750. This is 90. I forget what the number. We'd have to look at the 153.
If I could add something just briefly, Chair Przanski, on that point. Chair Przanski, Senator Cruz, and there's a certain amount of process that's implicated in that reduction to an attempt. You're still going to, I mean, the point you're even preliminarily cited, you're going to go to criminal court rather than violations court on a Class C. It's usually a violation done at arraignment, so there is some additional expense.
If I might ask counsel, does this have a referral to Ways and Means?
No.
No.
There's no fiscal.
Well, Chair Przanski, Senator Whitsitt, for public hearings, fiscals generally aren't ordered, so nobody's taken a crack at it from a fiscal perspective yet that I know of.
Okay, and to set the record straight as to the difference in the Class A violation, which is the highest violation, the maximum fine is $720. This one here is a Class D, which is the lowest violation, would be a maximum of 90.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much for coming forward. Let me just check one more time. Does anyone else want to give testimony on Senate Bill 607? I'm not seeing anyone come forward. We're going to go ahead and close that public hearing. Now, we have two work sessions, but before we do the work sessions, the prerogative of the chair is that I understand, I know for a fact that we have some students here from the Gilkey students, and so, Thomas, I know you're here because you're shadowing me. Who else is?
Arjun is working in my office.
Why don't y'all come on up to the podium, please? Is there anyone else here from Gilkey? Come on up.
A couple.
And if we need to bring up a couple more chairs, we've got chairs to bring up.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, we enjoy the opportunity to embarrass young people by this way.
Yeah. So I want to thank you all for being here today. I know that I think most of you were here yesterday. Mm-hmm. And since you're kind of like halfway through, I'm wondering if any of you would like to kind of give us your comments of what you've seen, what we might be able to do better, or any other suggestions you have. And if you're going to do that, the only thing we have to do is on the record have your name stated before you tell us what we should be listening to. And then I think the other part is, what can we do to help students in general?
And Mr. Chair, I'd also suggest that we have all of them put their name on the record so they will be part of Oregon history forever.
All right. Okay, so since I'm sitting as the chair, you have...
Yes.
Okay, so I'll do this. Thomas, I'm going to put you on the spot first, so you get to go first. And then whoever your shadow is, we'll go second, and we'll work through the other two. So, Thomas, just tell us your name.
Hello, my name is Thomas Prihoda, and
you're an eighth grader?
I'm an eighth grader from Gilkey, the French American International School, and I don't know what could be done better.
Okay, well, let me ask you about yesterday. I understand you were over at the Supreme Court building and you did some presentation.
Yeah, me and my classmates went over to the Supreme Court, and a few of the people in our school were part of the a case. We were basically doing a mock trial. Some of us were on the Ledbetter side. I was on that side. My friend Arjun here was on the Goodyear side. And then the German track and the Chinese track were the judges. And then everyone else was watching. And I believe they're going to be asking the governor and the secretary of state and the attorney general some questions today.
Okay.
Pretty cool.
Senator Cruz, you want to
introduce? Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Teddy Perenya.
I need you to move up just a little closer so we can all hear you.
My name is Teddy Perenya, and I also go to the French American International School. I'm also in eighth grade, and I don't really know. You could have done better either.
Okay.
Arjun is working in my office.
Okay, I'm Arjun, and I'm also in eighth grade from the Gilkey International Middle School. I don't really know exactly what could be done better, but I thought it was really interesting to go to all these committees and see the meetings and also look at all these different Senate and House bills because they're really interesting. I don't know what else I can say.
All right. Well, thank you.
Arjun got to sit in a meeting with me yesterday with a couple of lobbyists, including one who was here from Washington, D.C.
Oh, great.
And last gentleman?
I need you to get a little closer to the microphone, please.
My name is Kieran. I come from from SAIS, and I was not here the first day.
Okay.
Can't wait. And I think the bills are very interesting, and I think the school system is very good.
All right. Well, thank you all very, very much. We didn't want to really embarrass you, but we want to give you an opportunity to be part of the process. You're now part of the record, and we really thank you for being here today. As young individuals, hopefully in the future, we'll be leaders in this state. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
The senator in whose district the French American International School is, I welcome all the students. I know they've been doing this for many years, and their teachers do a great job of setting up the program, so we get to communicate with the students in advance, and I wish them all well.
Yeah. Thank you very much. All right.
Thank you.
So we're going to go ahead and open up our first work session that we have for today. And if y'all want to sit there, you can, or if you want to move back, your choice. And we'll see what they do. All right, we're going to go with work session on Senate Bill 396. Council.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 396 authorizes the sheriff to serve a copy of a protective order that has been transmitted to him by electronic communication device from a court of law enforcement agency. Allows the order to modify a restraining order to be served by mail under some circumstances. It provides when a peace officer accompanies a person to be restrained from a household in order for them to gather their personal effects. They have 20 minutes to gather those effects and will be permitted to do so only once, and grants the peace officer criminal and civil immunity from all liability committed by the restrained person during that period of gathering their effects. Fiscal and revenue have both been returned. There is no projected revenue impact, no projected fiscal impact on this bill or on the amendments. There are two amendments, a dash one and a dash two. The proponents wish that they be considered together and both adopted. I can provide summaries of dash ones and dash twos. The dash one does a few different things. First of all, it restores a requirement for personal service that was inadvertently deleted for service of modification requests. It restores the concepts that orders be entered into LEDs immediately after their receipt and that be a condition precedent for service. Clarifies the interrelationship of the service provisions related to modifications. The second dash two establishes the sheriff's responsibility to confirm that the device is working in the receiving office before transmitting a copy of an order for service, and that this applies when faxing or using electronic mail.
All right.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Chairman?
You may.
Yeah. Are those consensus amendments?
And Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I believe that they are, and furthermore, I should have said in the overview that there is somebody present in the courtroom. Kimberly Daly will answer any questions we have about how these amendments are to function.
I did see bobbing heads and nodding in the yes and affirmative, so it sounds like we are in agreement. And so does anyone have any questions that we'd like to have someone come up to talk any further about the amendments? Not Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 396.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments in the Senate Bill 396. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 396.
Senator Cruz now moves the dash twos into Senate Bill 396. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 396 as amended by the dash one and dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 396 as amended by the dash ones and the dash twos to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Any volunteers for 396? Senator Dingfelder will be the carrier on 396. We'll close the work session on 396, and we'll open up our last work session on Senate Bill 409.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 409 requires a judge to appoint a stenographic reporter for proceedings in aggravated murder trials with the cost to be paid by the Office of the State Court Administrator. A fiscal analysis was returned as indeterminate by the Legislative Fiscal Office. The rationale for that, and I'm quoting directly from the fiscal report, the fiscal impact is indeterminate. It is dependent upon the number of aggravated murder hearings and trials held, the length of the hearings and trials, the availability of staff court reporters employed by OJD or private contract court reporter rates and expense for such services. OJD would also incur a minimal fiscal impact for one-time and ongoing administrative expenses related to this measure. In the absence of a clear statement from the Legislative Fiscal Office about the projected fiscal implications of this bill, I would note again that there are individuals present who I believe would be able to provide some clarification as to fiscal impact. I know that Judiciary did prepare some figures for this bill.
All right. So, take some more.
My question would be, if it's indeterminate, does this need to go to Ways and Means to further flesh that out or not? I mean,
I don't think it does.
Okay. I mean, I support the bill. I just don't want to have unintended consequences budgetarily.
Yeah. Well, I would say the president's office can always flag it and pull it or move it. We've always, from my memories, worked when it's indeterminate to move forward, as compared to actually seeing, an actual estimate or value attached to what the cost actually is.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moldamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have some concerns about the cost, just because I'm looking at my notes and the estimate was at approximately $18,000 per case, but I don't find anything that talks about the number of cases that are anticipated to be included in this. Did we hear that testimony?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I think that's precisely the information that Judicial is sort of able to estimate. If we wanted to hear from anyone additional, I do remember that the preliminary estimates, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, that were submitted by Judiciary placed the cost preliminarily somewhere between $80,000 and $150,000 statewide. Give me a nod or a shake. I'm seeing some nods. Okay, good. But again, the experience, I think, of the state of Oregon is that the number of aggravated murder trials is one of those things that simply cannot be predicted. So the best, and that's the basis for the indeterminate, is the best we have is just the per case estimate.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I do support this bill, and I think that, to lend to the indeterminate, it's my understanding that these, if the trial is recorded, and almost all of these, I think all of them are appealed, so they would have to be transcribed anyway. So there would be having the record built originally would offset the cost of having it transcribed later, and it's also more accurate.
All right, that I'm not positive, but I think that's correct. Yeah. Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, in reading the bill, it has no emergency clause, which means it doesn't take effect till next January. We're back next February, so if in the meantime they've determined that there may be an impact, we can deal with it in February. So,
fair enough.
Okay, and based on that, Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 409 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 409 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any more discussions?
Mr. Chair, just a note that I do have concerns about the fiscal. I'll support the motion, but I'm making a statement that I'm going to look into it a little further before it gets to the floor.
That's fine. Any other comments? Any objection? So ordered. The Chair will carry 409 on the floor. And Council, anything else we need to cover? All right, and then if I'm correct, we have our regular start time, or what we're doing is our start time is 8:30.
You've changed your mind.
Yeah, and to be very frank with you, we may, I don't think it's this Thursday, but I think the following Thursday, we will probably be starting at 8. We're starting to see some of the council's work to back up on their days that are in. And so we will be, everything is defaulted for 8 a.m.
Right.
And then we're making changes at the end of the meeting the day before. So at this time, we are going to go with a start of 8:30. With that, for tomorrow, we're adjourned.